I'm Dan Hughes in the Old Time Radio Corner. John Nesbitt was a sailor, a janitor, an actor, a movie producer, a writer, and a narrator. He was born in 1910, and he died in 1960. From 1937 to 1951, he wrote and narrated a weekday 15-minute radio show called The Passing Parade. In those 15 years, he did over 1,500 shows. And he has not one, but two stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. John Nesbitt had inherited from his father a trunk full of old news clippings of strange and wondrous stories, little known but intriguing facts from all over the world. He used these stories in his radio show. His programs covered disasters, disappearances, inventions, fanatics, swindlers, prehistoric animals, adventurers, famous fighters, treasure hunters, prison breaks, amazing coincidences, and unexplained phenomena. His first radio series was called Headlines of the Past. Then he did The Passing Parade. Since the show ran just 15 minutes, you'll hear two episodes here. Both are from 1949, but the actual month and day of broadcast are unknown. Our first show is called Small Incidents, and it tells of several seemingly minor events which were responsible for much more important events. And the second show tells the true story of an airplane that crashed into the Empire State Building. From 1949, here's John Nesbitt and The Passing Parade.
America's foremost teller of tales, John Nesbitt. How do you do, everyone, for today's chapter in the 1949 edition of our Passing Parade. And after the announcer's introduction, we'll transcribe a whole hatful of notes and anecdotes for our current series about the men and women who changed the world forever as they marched in time's passing parade. Watching the procession move by again, as we consider this group of stories about people who changed the world, we might, of course, keep right on with such a subject for the next 22 and a half years. Because, of course, every man and woman of us, to some extent, alters the world forever for those who come after. Every time we vote for president, for example, we are each of us affecting the destiny of descendants who will come after us 1,000 years after we are dead and forgotten. And if you ran that idea right down to its last possibility, you would have to admit that each of us never goes to bed at the close of any day without having done something that will find a place in the future. For the future is a very big place. To begin with a very trivial and foolish example, consider the fact that on July the 23rd in 1851, a rather rattle-brained female named Mrs. Amelia Bloomer got out of a carriage at Lowell, Massachusetts, and rocked the world back on its heels. Mrs. Bloomer was a woman with a tidy private income and nothing much to occupy her. She found a cause to fill her life, however, when she became upset about the long and trailing skirts which women wore in her day. She decided that for a lady to have so many yards of cloth dragging along behind her that she stirred up a small dust storm every time she crossed the street was a most evil state of affairs. So Mrs. Bloomer, on July the 23rd, was prepared. She climbed down from her carriage, she crossed the sidewalk, and she rang the doorbell of a large and fashionable mansion where she had been invited to tea. When the butler opened the door for Mrs. Bloomer, he turned purple in the face. And when her hostess came sweeping up to greet Mrs. Bloomer, she turned dead white in the face. For Mrs. Bloomer was wearing a get-up that would shock a Zulu. She was wearing a short skirt, which came about halfway between her knee and ankle, as women's skirts seem to be doing right now. But because she did not have enough courage to show the shape of her legs below the skirt, she had installed under it a prodigious bulgy pair of trousers, ballooning out about a foot wide and then gathered modestly tight around her ankles. Although she was wearing at least 12 yards of material, this outfit of Mrs. Bloomer's was not only considered crazy, but illegal, indecent, and immoral. She was asked to leave the party, which she did. And within 24 hours, her costume was a headline sensation. Ministers based sermons upon it. All being opposed violently, by the way, local ordinances were passed making it a jail offense to be seen in a rig like it. And in general, both men and their wives greeted the whole idea with a shout of rage. The garment which she had invented was called, of course, Bloomer's, and as such is titled to this day. For 75 years, Mrs. Bloomer's invention had no effect whatsoever upon women's styles, which remained in the field of total idiocy. Only then did girls, wishing more freedom of physical movement, begin chopping at the hems of their skirts, and then out of modesty, they had, of course, to make use of a pair of Mrs. Bloomer's creation. But to get back to our theme, how could such a small matter possibly be described as one that changed the world? At the time that Mrs. Bloomer kicked over the apple cart of proper social behavior, women in America had reached a point of slavery to men and to their own customs, which was more complete than it had ever been before in our history or since. Not only had middle-class women become enslaved, but they had accepted the idea completely and defended it cheerfully. Many a delicate lady was proud of being stupid, proud of being weak. And most mothers carefully taught their daughters that all serious mental responsibility was to be left to the men, and complete obedience to one's husband was the only way to happiness. It is one of the supreme tragedies of humanity that far more often than they have fought for freedom, slaves of every kind, political slaves or economic slaves, have kissed their chains and said, "Slavery like this is the only respectable way to live." So Mrs. Bloomer, merely by dressing as she personally saw fit, demonstrated the astounding theory that a woman might have a mind of her own. While virtually no other woman found courage to follow her example, Mrs. Bloomer was remembered through the generations as a gal with the courage to defy the men. When the great women's suffrage movements began, it was Mrs. Bloomer who was one of the patron saints, a symbol of independence. And in her period, she was almost the first of the great fighters. The idea grew until it was a national riot. Millions of women at last were defying the convention that childbearing and housework were a woman's sole privileges, until at last they won the vote in 1920. A world-changing movement has to begin somewhere. In this case, one of its major opening battles began when Mrs. Amelia Bloomer sailed in through the front door of a mansion and said, "How do you like it, girls? A little thing that I whipped up myself." This seems a good place to break for the announcer, after which we're going to examine another apparently minor incident, which is beyond question one of the titanic world-changing events of all time in the passing parade.
He is a writer, and one day an acquaintance asked this writer what was the greatest writing ever produced in this country. He named a set of laws upon which all other laws in this country rest: the Constitution of the United States, with its amendments, especially the Bill of Rights. Nothing else has ever been written in this country that guarantees so much to so many, he said. And isn't that a good test of great writing? Yes, look at it this way. The law guarantees freedom of speech, press, worship, and assembly. But it also urges and inspires you to speak and write the truth, to worship with a full and humble heart, and to assemble for the good of all people. I can't see how anyone can think of the law as something that fences you in, the writer said. Rather, it is the one thing that can keep you free. So the law is my friend and yours, and I am the law's friend, as I hope you are. For as I see it, freedom is everybody's job. Now, once again, to John Nesbitt.
On the reviewing stand once more, to follow the trail of very small happenings which changed the world, probably the outstanding example of history took place 41 years before the birth of Christ, when a Roman ambassador looked a moment too long into the eyes of a middle-aged Egyptian woman known as Cleopatra. According to the ancient records, Queen Cleopatra, when she heard that the mighty Mark Antony himself was coming to take over Egypt for the Roman Empire, decided that while there was no stopping Rome, she could at least put the matter on a personal basis. Mark Antony, you see, was a trained and tough diplomat soldier. He was working in the toughest, most professional foreign service that this earth has ever known. When he went to Egypt to organize that country as a puppet state for Rome, he was in the same position that such a man as Molotov is if he is sent out by the Kremlin to fulfill a mission. He follows instructions to the letter, as probably his life hinges upon his making no mistakes. Mark Antony had been warned by the Secret Service of Rome about this Cleopatra. He knew that she'd been married many times. He knew that she had had many children, and he knew that she was one of the cleverest women in the world. And yet, when this broken and smashed ruler, Cleopatra,
came to meet the Roman conqueror, she came as a woman. She rode a magnificent barge down the Nile, a barge loaded with musicians and dancers, and she turned a bitter capitulation into a celebration of welcome. So the meeting between Cleopatra and Mark Antony must go down as an incident that changed the world forever. For within a matter of weeks, this great professional soldier and diplomat was ready to betray his own headquarters. He was chained in what they say is the maddest of all entanglements, which is a middle-aged love affair. Think of this. Both of these people already had grown children, grandchildren. Cleopatra was dark-skinned, she was fat and wrinkled. Mark Antony was gray and growing stiff with age. Before coming to Egypt, he had reached a point in his career where he was the emperor of one-third of the Roman Empire, which is to say he was one-third stockholder in the entire civilized world. Yet when headquarters got around to straightening out the failure of his mission in Egypt and sent a navy to take over, the man who was owner of a third of the world was there to fight against Rome for his sweetheart's Egypt. He was smashed, he committed suicide, Cleopatra followed him into death. Now, because Antony failed on this mission, the immense empire of Rome reached a point of chaos. So a strong, single dictator had to take over. Republican government became a myth. Earth's greatest civilization was ruled for more than a generation by this one man. He was the first of the absolute Roman emperors. And although a wise and brilliant man, that long rule of his smashed the tradition of voting and people's representation. Rome thereafter fell into the hands of the corrupt and insane emperors like Nero. It was rescued for 90 years by a string of good emperors and then sank into the long rottenness and decay that killed her. So the wonder of the ages, the mightiest of empires, turned into a one-man show and tumbled to disaster when the one-man system failed her, as it always will. Because in the crucial hour, weary Mark Antony met a middle-aged woman in Egypt on the banks of the Nile. The magic of Cleopatra is an unsolved mystery to this hour. Her power over Antony couldn't have been physical beauty, not merely because she was many years past her prime, but because Antony could have had a harem of 100 picked beauty winners at any moment that he chose to issue the request. I suspect that Cleopatra's gift was the power of friendship. This fabulously powerful man was lonely and sought a comrade. And that, I think, is what utterly changed the world. But now take a jump through the centuries with us to a moment when so trivial and ridiculous a thing as a few buzzing houseflies turned the trick to turn the ways of the world. The American Declaration of Independence is the document which, as we all know, gave birth to a really new world. The United States is its child. And yet, many long days after Jefferson toiled to put it down on paper, and a full month after John Hancock put that huge signature of his on the document, the balance of the men who were to add their names to it were still nervous or uncertain about signing it. As men will, they argued ceaselessly over every sentence, every word and semicolon. Some were in favor of making it more conservative and polite, in other words, playing it safe, and others insisted that it be a screaming declaration of war. On the 2nd of August, 1776, a full month after it had been written, they were still haggling over it and refusing to set down their names. And now, according to no less an authority than Thomas Jefferson himself, the summer day got hotter and hotter until the patriots were almost too exhausted to argue. And then in through the windows, which had to be opened to let in some fresh air, came a swarm of flies from a livery stable nearby. The flies buzzed through the room, they lighted on the legs of the representatives, and they began to sting. And men in those days, you'll remember, wore fine silk stockings and knee-length trousers. After a few minutes, the delegates were frantic with the desire to get out of the room, and with a sudden, impatient rush, they stamped up and they signed the Declaration of Independence. Unless the afternoon had been so hot, and unless the flies had therefore swarmed through the open windows, that whole immense discussion might have bogged down in lawyers' hair-splitting and tricky debate. But because of a cloud of hungry flies, the nation which now stands as the chief hope of free mankind was hurried into being. In that sense, therefore, a swarm of flies must join the rest of our marchers in the company of those who forever changed the world. Our time's up. Here's the announcer before a brief note on the next edition.
Mutual is America's Sunday suit, and here are 9 reasons why Mutual suits everyone on Sunday. The wise and witty juvenile jury the superstition debunking house of mystery, tales of true police detection on True Detective Mysteries, super suspense with the all-knowing shadow, electrifying entertainment with the dramatized quiz quick as a flash, western music and adventure with the Roy Rogers Show, action mystery with Nick Carter, a comedy drama with Lionel Barrymore as mayor of the town, and your favorite music with Johnny Desmond. So for all radio, all-time Sunday favorite to suit you, suit me, suit everyone, tune to most of these stations on Sunday. And remember, regardless of daylight saving time, you'll hear all your favorite Sunday shows at the usual time on Mutual. For slow time, fast time, it's time to tune to Mutual. Now, a final word from John Nesbitt.
When we meet again, we'll begin a new series of great adventure yarns. Until then, this is John Nesbitt transcribing from California a goodbye to you all.
Tune in tomorrow when Mutual will again present the voice of America's foremost teller of tales, John Nesbitt. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
John Nesbitt and the Passing Parade. Here's another episode, this one about an airplane that crashed into the Empire State Building.
The Passing Parade. Your favorite stories as told by your favorite storyteller. A man whose voice is familiar to millions of theatergoers and radio listeners. Here's John Nesbitt to bring you some stories from The Passing Parade.
On the reviewing stand, nearly all the unforgettable errors of human judgment which have written airplane disaster into the headlines are unsolved mysteries. The men who make the mistakes or are suddenly overwhelmed by the mistakes of others are killed and there are no living witnesses. Not on this side of heaven will we ever learn what took place in some young man's brain the split second before he crashed. An outstanding example of the baffling character of most of these catastrophes is the case of the airplane which did something that the nation had half expected for 20 years and yet didn't quite believe could happen. The 10-ton Army bombing plane which met its death in a fraction of a moment when it struck the tallest office building in the world. You can't build up any special kind of story. The cold, breathtaking record is all that we ever have. Just before 10 in the morning on Saturday, July 28, 1945, a girl named Nanette Morrison is working away at her typewriter by the window on the 38th floor of a Fifth Avenue skyscraper. Nanette Morrison looks up from her typewriter to see a huge Army airplane roaring past her window. This was a time in the war, you'll remember, when Army and Navy pilots used to get themselves in hot water occasionally by flying close to their girls' houses and buzzing them in daredevil plunges of the planes. For this reason, as the big airplane shoots past her window, Nanette Morrison laughs and waves her hand to the men in the cockpit. And at the same instant, she senses that it is death she is signaling. The young men are sitting like frozen statues in the cockpit, hypnotized by their peril, their arms tearing at the controls, to try to get their plane to climb. Nanette stands there in the skyscraper window, frozen too now, her fist jammed against her lips. Hundreds and perhaps thousands of New Yorkers, like Nanette, glanced up at that instant to gaze upon the birth of a disaster. And since it was unbelievable, few of them could realize what their eyes were announcing to them. Another New York girl named Maria Little writes in her report to me, "I was window shopping down below on Fifth Avenue looking at the coats in Lord and Taylor's. The roar of the propellers frightened me. I looked up to see the plane shooting straight down the avenue between the tall buildings, and I thought it was a stunt. I said to a friend, 'If that dizzy flyer isn't careful, he'll go right on until he runs into the Empire State Building.' We both laughed, and we turned back to look at a mink coat, and my friend said, 'Yes, that's what Mayor LaGuardia is always complaining about,' and then we both gasped, for a roar like a munitions factory exploding shook the entire center of town. Perhaps 50,000 people confessed willingly later that their first thought had been, 'America is being attacked from the air by some new rocket bomb.' At this moment, a cloudburst of concrete, of metal, and jagged pieces of glass was showering down on Fifth Avenue and 34th Street, from where rises the tallest man-made pinnacle upon the globe, the Empire State. 90 feet away from the point between the 78th and the 79th floors, where this bomb of metal and living men had struck, there was a sculptor's studio. Through seven thick walls tore an immense motor from the demolished airplane, and that motor plummeted into the artist's studio and demolished it. The second motor was found later deep in the basement of the skyscraper, 925 feet from the point of that indescribable impact between a bombing plane and a tower. And there was no mystery about this. For the second motor had passed through walls of brick and empty offices, had penetrated an elevator shaft, and then dropped like a stone to the basement. In the higher offices, that is, in the higher windows of office buildings nearby the Empire State, men had been sitting at their desks, feet up on the blotters, telephoning their wives about getting home early that Saturday. Others were salesmen, getting in a few last orders before closing shop. Others, hundreds of others, were office girls, telephoning companions and planning shopping expeditions in the early afternoon. There was a cool mist that morning, and Midtown Manhattan, which is no place for man or beast during a July heat wave, was on this day a very pleasant place to hunt for scarce merchandise or take in a matinee. So when, through the fog, the ghost-like shape hurtled past, and the bellow of sound shook the metropolis, all of those telephoners in the windows simply stopped speaking in the middle of the breath at once. At the other end of 100 lines, the wives and the boyfriends and the customers began jiggling the receiver stand, signaling the operator that they were cut off. Or they kept saying into the mouthpiece, "What is it? Why have you stopped talking?" A long, long wait. And then the reply, "In God's name, I don't know, but I guess we're invaded." We'll sum up the records of this mystery, which holds no solution, just as soon as our announcer takes the usual intermission here, and then the evidence that remains concerning the unbelievable traffic accident of the passing parade. In the many minutes of dazed horror and confusion that began with the dying out of the explosion when the airplane cut its way into the Empire State Building, it might be expected that panic would make its appearance and attend to its usual business of piling horror upon horror and extending the death list. But here, for once, panic, the great destroyer in disaster, did not tear loose and bring madness into the story. The day and the hour saved hundreds of lives. For it was Saturday morning, and the five-day week had become the usual way in the United States. So instead of there being 15,000 living people in the Empire State Building at the moment of the crash, there was only a tenth that number, 1,500. Besides the pilot and his crew, 10 people died in their offices, while 26 others were wounded but survived. Many of these owe their lives to another accident. This accident being that at the moment of the disaster, walking along the sidewalk past the skyscraper, there was a 17-year-old boy with brains and a steady heart. His name was Donald Maloney. He was very proud of serving his country, even though he was too young for active duty and was a hospital apprentice in the Coast Guard. As this boy jumped back from the sinister rain of shredded glass and metal that whistled down through the air to Fifth Avenue, he remembered at once that he was being trained to administer to bodies shattered by war. Young Donald kept his head, as thousands of others gazed upward, gasping about an invasion or some new weapon of the enemy. He dashed into a drugstore. Minutes before the ambulance sirens could be heard wailing down the streets, this Donald was shouting to a drug clerk to give him morphine, hypodermic needles, and other restricted drugs. And the clerk had sense enough to recognize that the law mustn't hold in such a moment, and he gave the boy these supplies. Donald was in the Empire State Building, had fought his way to the elevators, and been taken to the chaos of the floors which had been penetrated by the shattered plane, and within a few moments was treating the screaming victims. And then he squeezed through a knife-edged crevice in the tangled wreckage of machinery. He administered morphine to a woman caught in the mass of twisted metal, and he brought her out of it alive. The five-day working week saved hundreds, and the boy from the Coast Guard saved his dozens. And then there is the record of a second steady heart in that hour. One of the most likely places where panic might have flared out but failed to appear was on the famous observation gallery in the topmost pinnacle of that immense building. 35 tourists that morning had paid their fee, and at the instant the great projectile dug into the skyscraper, these persons were lined up behind the plate glass on the gallery of floor 86. A flash of flame enveloped the whole tower, and caught as they were up there at the top of the highest building on the earth, a state of frenzy might have arrived. But as the overwhelmed visitors looked at their uniformed guide, this man quietly pulled himself together, and in his most professional tone, he requested them to accompany him at once. The dazed tourists obeyed him. He gathered them together and herded them politely to the 65th floor, where they took the elevator to the street. The guide's name is Louis Petley. When his routine life brought him this incredible moment of importance, he met his requirement with valor. For the rest of it, the experts came, the generals and the engineers came, and as they knew in advance, the puzzle was totally baffling. The pilot was competent and able, Lieutenant Colonel William Smith, Jr. With him was Staff Sergeant Christopher Dmitrovich,
and an enlisted man named Albert Perna. This doomed man had been feeling very lucky that morning. He was stuck in Bedford, Massachusetts, and at the last moment had been given the chance to hitchhike aboard this plane to glamorous New York. The bombing plane itself had as its name Old John Feather Merchant. It was in superb and in tested condition. The careful detective work piled up the clues minutely, but they were, of course, useless. It was determined that the big airplane had boomed through the canyon made by the buildings on Fifth Avenue at a speed of 19,800 feet each minute. That speed was not enough, as I understand it, for the craft to rise in time above the soaring tower that lay ahead. Mayor LaGuardia arrived at the place of the tragedy within minutes of the echoing thunder, and he said the obvious thing. He was flying too low. And although this opinion might sound preposterously unnecessary, it contains the only fact which is certain. For the cause of the 18-foot hole in the skin of the Empire State Building, for the deaths of the 10 and for the instant oblivion that took the men aboard the plane, the cause lies in some microscopic connection in the brain of the pilot. This invisible failure of human thinking hides the mystery of the disaster. It was this that led the pilot to fly appallingly low over Manhattan Island on a morning of blinding fog. It was this that led him to ignore a radioed warning that came to the plane from LaGuardia Field. And ironically, the weather tower actually used a phrase that prophesied the incomprehensible accident. For the warning was, the visibility is so bad we can't even see the top of the Empire State Building. So whether there was a dreadful cross-circuit in the brain of an intelligent man, or a hidden failure within the intricate workings of the airplane, the story, like the others, must go down the years without a conclusion. The men who make the airplanes and the men who fly them, they simply stopped long enough to draw in their breaths as they read the news. It's part of the down payment we must make to capture the sky, they said, and they went on with their work. Whether they spoke it aloud or not, all of these men knew that this was exactly what would have been wanted by the men who desperately fought that airplane amok as it whistled like an arrow straight down Fifth Avenue to oblivion.
You have been listening to your favorite stories as told by America's favorite storyteller, John Nesbitt. Be with us the next time we move to the reviewing stand for yet another glimpse of The Passing Parade. This is the United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.
And there you have two episodes of the 15-minute John Nesbitt show, The Passing Parade. Thanks for listening. If there are old-time radio programs you remember and would like to hear again, drop me a note at Dan, D-A-N, at radiofun.info, I-N-F-O. In the Old Time Radio Corner, I'm Dan Hughes.